Goal in this lesson is to get through chapter 19, but the way my voice is going today, we may not make it. Anthony, you might have the invitation song ready. We'll go till it gives out. So the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, as well as Admah and Zeboiim, those are added suburb-type cities, I suppose, to those that were destroyed in this chapter. Deuteronomy 29:23 mentions the others. This is not strictly an aspect of Abraham's life in a direct sense, and this series that I'm doing through the year also, along with the Gospel of John, is on the life of Abraham. But since we read last time in chapter 18 that God had determined that because of the relationship that he has with Abraham, and then I would suppose by extension the relationship Abraham has with Lot, that God honored Abraham by revealing his purposes in destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. And that led to the bargaining, if you will, that Abraham entered into with God. Well, if there's this many righteous, if there's this many righteous, would you spare the city? And God had endured patiently, Abraham whittling that number down to 10, and said, if I can find 10 righteous people, I suppose in all of these cities combined, I will not destroy them. And of course, we know the outcome of that. There weren't 10 righteous, and we'll see that in the lesson tonight. And so this is a disturbing, it is a non-politically correct chapter of the Bible in our day and time today, but it is there. It did happen. God had lessons in mind for us to learn from the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in such a graphic way. And so it is not our practice to ignore or skip over parts of the Bible that don't agree with the modern mindset. And so this would not be obviously considered very politically correct, but nonetheless, these are the actions and the words of God. And if we're going to be pleasing to God, we need to honor all of what God has to say and honor all of what God has done. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to get through the narrative portion of this. And then if I have enough voice left, we'll make some applications and talk about some more personal things in regard to what actually happens in this chapter. But in verses 1 through 11, we find the stage is set for us here in terms of why God took such a dim view of Sodom and Gomorrah, and why he had come down initially with two angels. And as he said to Abraham, a great outcry has come to me against Sodom and Gomorrah, and I have come down to see, as it were, the nature of the outcry. Well, it's not that God is not aware, but the case is being made clear. And the way we would view this chapter in our society today vindicates God. And I'll say something about that as we go along. But God and Abraham have had this discussion as to under what conditions he would spare Sodom and Gomorrah. And then the two angels go on to Sodom. And we find in the opening verses of the chapter that the angels come to the gate of the city, and there is Lot. Lot is sitting there. We're not told anything about his expectation of these angels coming, whether he recognized them right away as being angels. But we do note that in the spirit of hospitality in the day, Lot is quick to open his home to these two men, who we know to be angels. Again, we don't know if Lot knew that right off the bat. But Lot offers for them to come into his home and to be cared for and provided for. And the angels at first rebuff that offer. They say, no, we're going to spend the night in the open square. And Lot knows, being a resident of this city, Lot knows the danger that that would put these men in. And so he presses his offer upon these two angels to bring them into his home. We'll pick up the reading in verse 4, chapter 19. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. And they called to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally." So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and said, "Please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly." Well, Lot's concerns are borne out. And this is just a hideous part of Scripture and what it reveals about human nature and what it reveals about the depths of the depravity into which men can fall. These two strangers come into town, apparently unknown to all as being angels. Again, we don't know what Lot thought exactly. But they come out in the evening and surround Lot's house, demanding that these angels be turned over to them for homosexual abuse. I don't know that the Bible reveals anything more heinous in terms of human behavior and again, the depths of depravity. This is an unimaginable display of degeneracy, even I would say in our own world, in our own culture. We can see a lot of things in our culture, but to have two men come into a town as strangers and have then the men of the city besiege that house, demanding that these two men be brought out to them, is just almost beyond what the mind can accept. And that in itself is part of the point. That's how far these people have gone. And this is what God has been hearing. God has been hearing cries against the city of Sodom and Gomorrah and the others because of their unbelievable immorality. And so here's Lot's response. This is almost as incredible as the demand for the two angels. Verse 8, "See now," Lot says, "I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof." And they said, "Stand back." Then they said, "This one came in to sojourn, and he keeps acting as a judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." So they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door. Again, perhaps as shocking as the demand for the angels to be brought out would be Lot's offer of his own daughters in lieu of the angels coming out, supposedly, and being subject to the mob. They would not have been. But I think also what we see in this is kind of a hard thing to grab hold of, because we tend to think of Lot, who is described as a righteous man, but he's been conditioned, apparently, by the moral devolution of his surroundings, to the point that he thinks this is a reasonable solution. This is just, for a father of three daughters, for me, this is just unimaginable. We simply, in this country, as bad as certain parts of it are, I can't even imagine the degeneracy of a father offering his daughters to a murderous and abusive mob. And yet this is exactly what Lot does, and this actually prefigures something that will happen later in the book of Judges among the Israelites. But picking up the reading in verse 10, "The men reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door." Lot went out to try to save the angels. The angels end up saving Lot. The angels didn't need saving. There wasn't anything that was going to happen to them. But Lot is not, again, aware of that on whatever level. Whether he knows they're angels or he just considers them to be sojourners passing through, he feels like he's honor bound, I suppose, to offer his daughters as a substitute, but yet that is a poor solution. That is an unimaginably off-limits solution. No one should ever think this way or do this way. And yet Lot has been led down this path to so offer his daughters. I'll just tell you, I mean, this is creepy to me. These people have been stricken blind by these angels and they're still pawing at the door, trying to find their way in. I mean, I don't hardly have the words to talk about how degenerate this picture is. And yet, this is what happens. Being stricken blind did not derail their lustful plans. This is how overtaken they are by the sensuousness of their minds. And so this sets the scene, and it is a dismal scene. When the angels of God come into a city, and this is the response they get, it is the explanation why God does what he does with this city. In verse 12, the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in this city, take them out of this place, for we will destroy this place, because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord has sent us to destroy it." If Lot had any doubt about who these men were, that doubt is gone now. They reveal to Lot what their plans are, what their mission is, why they've been sent. And they tell Lot, "Gather up everyone of your family in this city, because this is what we are going to do." We're aware, we who study the Bible know the story and we know the outcome of it. We're aware that Lot will escape with two of his daughters, but Lot has more family in the city. The angels say, "Do you have sons, son-in-law, daughters?" So apparently Lot's family is bigger than maybe what we think, because he only escapes at least partially with his wife and then with his two daughters. I don't know that we would be unreasonable to presuppose grandchildren, perhaps, that Lot might have in the city. But the warning is given to gather up your family and get out. It's going to be destroyed. So Lot went out, verse 14, and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters, so he had more daughters than the two that left with him, and said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. You know, people today joke about the judgment. We talked about the judgment this morning, that Jesus is the source of life and he will be our judge. And you know how carnal people respond to that judgment? Just like these children and in-law children of Lot responded to a message of judgment. They laughed about it. Well, surely that's not going to happen. They did not believe Lot. Yeah, you know, sure. And Lot was not able to persuade them to leave the city. So in verse 15, when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." As I read further from verse 16 on, note Lot's dilly-dallying. He is on the verge of being swept up in the destruction of these cities, and he's wasting time, dragging his feet, reluctant to go. Verse 16, while he lingered, the men took hold of his hand and his wife's hand and the hands of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him out and set him outside the city. So it came to pass when they had brought them outside that he said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed." And Lot said, "Surely I'll run." Nope. Lot said, "Please, no, my lords." He's objecting. "Indeed, now your servant has found favor in your sight, and you've increased your mercy, which you have shown me by saving my life." But, I mean, should Lot have any buts here? Excuse me, I have a point to make. The angels are saying, "Get out of the city. We're going to destroy it." Oh, well, hold on a minute. "But I cannot escape to the mountains," he says in verse 19, "lest some evil overtake me and I die." An evil is about to overtake you, and you're going to die. And God's already giving him provision for life. Does Lot really think God's going to lead him out into the mountains so he'll just expire? See now, this city is near enough to flee to, and it is a little one. Please let me escape there. Is it not a little one? And my soul shall live. He sounds like his uncle, doesn't he? Didn't Abraham bargain with God? And Lot's bargain isn't going to turn out any better than Abraham's. Nonetheless, God says, or the angel speaking for God, see, I have favored you concerning this thing also, in that I will not overthrow this city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of that city was called Zoar. It's just hard for us to imagine because we know the story, and Lot is in the middle of it. But God has shown mercy to Lot by giving him ample, clear warning to vacate the city, lest he is destroyed. And he's arguing about it. And yet God accommodates him. God gives him time and opportunity and accedes to his request to go to Zoar instead of going to the mountains. Verse 23, the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. Then the Lord rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of the heavens. So he overthrew those cities, all the plain, all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But his wife looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. And Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Lord. Then he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land, which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, which he overthrew when he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt. So here we finally do have the judgment of God falling upon these cities. There isn't anything in the narrative here that would lead us to the conclusion that a volcano erupted or something of that sort. This seems to be a miraculous, direct judgment of God, the raining of fire and brimstone out of heaven. This is a direct action of God. And it did not just affect one place, which I would suppose in general might be the effect of a volcano, though this is not strictly in this area volcanic. But if that were to happen, it's probably unlikely that all of the cities that are mentioned here would be affected. But we have in verse 26, it's kind of a puzzling part of all of this, and this is Lot's wife looking back. The warning had been given not to look back, and yet it seems by the narrative here that children were left behind in the city. It might be, we would think, you know, on her behalf, a curiosity. I don't know what was in her mind to look back. We're not told that. We're simply told that they were warned not to look back. And yet Lot's wife does. It doesn't seem in keeping with God's nature. And I don't want to speak too much on God's behalf and be wrong about it. But it does not sound like it's the kind of judgment God would bring upon someone for the concern for their children being left behind, or a matter of mere curiosity. It seems more likely that Lot's wife was looking back with longing or regret of having to leave. It would be natural curiosity to know what's going on behind you, but nonetheless, the command was given not to look back. And so the price that she paid for that was to lose her life. I don't know why God chose to make her a pillar of salt. This is an area filled with salt pits, and it's pretty much desolate even today. But nonetheless, this is the fate that befell her because she, for whatever reason, did not heed the command of God. But this is also involving Abraham again, where Abraham is now looking out where he had the discussion with God, and this is what he's now seeing. This is the answer to whether there were 10 found in the city. Would you spare it for the sake of 10? I will spare it for the sake of 10. Well, Abraham gets his answer, doesn't he? There weren't 10 people to be found. Ultimately, there was only 4. Well, 3, if we discount Lot's wife turning into a pillar of salt. Lot and his 2 daughters. It's a very sad story. It brings out the worst in human nature, not only in the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, but it wasn't Lot's finest day either. And this is not all. Again, Lot thinks he's got a better solution to God. I don't want to go to the mountains. I want to go to this city. I want to go to Zoar instead. Okay, I'll let you go to Zoar. Then Lot went up out of Zoar, in verse 30, and dwelt in the mountains, where he was told to go at the first. And his 2 daughters were with him, for he was afraid to dwell in Zoar, and he and his 2 daughters dwelt in a cave. Now the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is no man on earth to come into us, as is the custom of all the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and we will lie with him, that we may preserve the lineage of our father." So they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And I'm not going to finish the reading there. Most of us would know it. But the same thing happens with the other daughter, and both of them become impregnated by their own father. Again, our moral conformity to society's norms and values can have long-term and long-ranging effects, and here we see it again. We saw it with Lot offering his daughters in the first place to the men of the city, and that was not what they wanted. And here we see their further behavior with their own father. Again, this story stretches our credulity. We read this and say, how could people do these kinds of things? But in asking that question, we're really answering the question of why God did what he did. These are unimaginable acts of immorality. And as God stated, "I have heard the outcry against this city, and I've come to judge it," and so he does. One other point to notice here about the actions of his daughters, they give birth to the Moabites and the Ammonites. They thought, again, they were solving a problem, and they created so many problems for Israel down the road in their history by this ungodly and immoral act. Well, let's think about some applications and some questions to ask ourselves, perhaps, in this regard. Well, as I indicated in the first part of the lesson, this is a clear, dramatic, unequivocal judgment of God that is such a powerful statement in the Scriptures against homosexuality that homosexual advocates in our day have a very difficult time with this. And this is not the only passage in the New Testament. There are many others we could point to that must be somehow excised from Scripture for pro-homosexuals to advocate their practices. And so, at the end of the day, this tragic story is almost made a joke by many, who will say things like, well, it wasn't homosexuality itself that God was judging. It was violent homosexuality. That if it's loving homosexuality, if it's homosexual behavior between 2 people in a relationship, God is okay with that because God just wants us to be happy. Or another explanation is given that these people just were destroyed by God for the lack of hospitality they were showing to the angels. It really didn't have anything to do with homosexual behavior. You know, it would be better, I think, for those advocates to just say, we should pay no attention to the Bible. Don't try to explain this away. I mean, it's as clear as it can be. And Romans 1 is clear as it can be. 1 Corinthians 6 is clear as it can be. Homosexuality is something that God condemns. And if we find that message offensive, it really isn't going to help our cause to twist and turn the Scriptures into something that they do not say. It would be more honest, I suppose, to just simply say the Bible ought not to be listened to, and believe it or not, there are some people that do that. I want to share with you some observations by a man named Robert Williams. I have no doubt this is a name that you do not know. I didn't know. He was the first openly gay clergyman in the Episcopalian Church here in the United States. And he has written a book advocating homosexuality, though he considers himself to be a religious man. So you might wonder, well, what do people say in order to circumvent passages like this? Well, here's just a flat denial of the need to listen to the Bible. Okay, this is Robert Williams writing. The point is not really whether or not some passage in the Bible condemns homosexual acts. The point is that you cannot allow your moral and ethical decisions to be determined by the literature of a people whose culture and history are so far removed from your own. You must dare to be iconoclastic enough to say, quote, so what if the Bible does say it? Who cares? This is a religious clergyman who is a homosexual and says, well, this has no bearing on us today. He also comments further, this time in regard to Paul, not Exodus 19. Perhaps Paul is condemning homosexuality in this passage, or at least labeling it as unnatural, the references to Romans 1, which is not exactly the same thing as calling it sinful. But the bottom line for you is, so what? Paul was wrong about a number of other things, too. Why should you take him any more seriously than you take Jerry Falwell or Anita Bryant or Cardinal O'Connor? I mean, I'm not even going to answer this. I don't need to. You hear what the man is saying. We don't need to listen to the Bible. And then this. Paul, like most of us, had his good moments and his bad moments. It cannot be believed unless it rings true to our deepest capacity for truth and goodness. Any discussion of the household of God, then, that degenerates into a list of those who will not get into the club should strike you as misguided. It does not ring true to our deepest capacity for truth and goodness. This passage then simply has no authority for you. Brazen, isn't it? So what did he say? I filter God's commands through my prism. I decide whether that rings true to me. And of course, the man is a practicing homosexual. Of course, it's not going to ring true to him. It isn't going to sound like a message of goodness to him. Wonder how many people that man has influenced in teaching such drivel as that, which basically completely neuters the Bible of any authority that it obviously has since it comes from God. I mean, this is a travesty, it's ridiculous, and yet you know who people are probably going to listen to who are already agreeable to homosexual practice. So whether it's Paul in Romans 1, or whether it's Paul in 1 Corinthians 6, or whether it's Genesis 19, or whether it's the other prohibitions in the law of Moses against homosexual behavior, you may as well do what this man does and just say, well, you shouldn't be listening to that anyway. Because the message is clear from Scripture that God considers homosexual behavior to be an abomination. Whether it's between two loving people, whether it's violent between two people, whether it's between two strangers, really doesn't matter. It's the act itself that is an abomination in the sight of God. Second thing I want to emphasize is something I've already touched on, and that is, how long had God already been merciful to Sodom? We read about something like this and but it might be easy to think, well, God's overreacting here. I mean, he completely, wipes these cities off the face of the earth to make a point that still is a matter of debate today. And yet, God has already said to Abraham, the cry against these cities has come up before me. In 1820, which we talked about in our last lesson, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down. And then in Genesis 15, in verse 16, God already said to Abraham that the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete, and that was going to take another 500 years before God finally judged the Canaanites. So my question is, how long has God already been patient with Sodom and Gomorrah? If he's going to be patient with the Amorites and the others in the land of Canaan, 500 more years, how long have they been doing this? We don't have that answer in the Bible, but we do know one thing. God is a patient God. God is not known to act capriciously or certainly prematurely. God gives ample warning before he does something especially as dramatic as this. And so I think we can rightly draw the conclusion this is not some knee-jerk action or overreaction by God. It's only the result that takes place after a lot of patient continuance in giving these people an opportunity to repent. The third point I want to ask is this. Would you offer your children to the mob? Now, asking that of this group, everybody probably just recoiled and said, well, of course not. But I'm going to tell you, there are people in our society today offering their children to the mob. I'll only reference one thing. That's the trans movement. There are parents offering their children up to butchery. Evil. This is not being done, and I know that schools are protecting children in certain ways and keeping information from parents. But a lot of the problem behind 12, 13, 14, some even younger children questioning their gender and having surgeries and drugs being given to them is traceable to the parents. There are parents in our society offering their children up to the mob. We read about those that sacrificed their children to Molech in the Old Testament, and we're mortified by that. And we should be. Now, I know in this audience, we would not do that. What I would only say, though, in this regard is, we need to be careful that we don't become so conditioned by our culture that we don't see what we're doing. I want to give Lot the benefit of that doubt. I don't know that I should. But Lot, do you know what you're doing? When you offered your daughters to the mob, do you know what you're doing? And I don't know how to answer that other than to say he had been conditioned. Yes, his soul was vexed with the unrighteous behavior of these people, but I would submit to you that he's been affected by it. And so it is daughters. And the warning simply is this. We need to be careful that we're not inadvertently offering our children up to the mob. That we're not letting them be influenced, or we're not encouraging them in some form or fashion to be exposed to the deleterious effects of our culture. And that's how easy it is for our culture to invade, to affect our thinking, to affect our values, to where it might be that we're not as diligent, we're not as vigilant as we need to be, because we ourselves might be affected by the culture. You know, as somebody has expressed to me, and it's a pretty good illustration, but if we're just a little more righteous than the culture around us, we tend to move with the culture. You know, as the culture gets further out, we just say to ourselves, well, I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. I'm not that bad. And we're measuring ourselves according to the cultural standards, saying, well, we're not as bad as what these other people are doing. That's not the standard. What everybody else is doing isn't the standard. What God says is the standard. And how closely are we holding to that? And then another question that arises for us out of this story is, are we heeding the warnings of God? Lot, get out of the city. Oh, wait a minute, I have an objection. I don't want to go to the mountains. Again, we read this and it's like unbelievable that Lot is dragging his feet getting out of the city. Are we heeding God's warnings? God tells us to do something very similar to what's being told to Lot. 2 Corinthians 6, beginning in verse 17, "Come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord. Do not touch what is unclean, and I'll receive you. Let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." What, but do I have to go that far? Now, wait a minute, Lord. You don't understand. This culture, I'm better than most people in this culture. But, you know, ungodliness is all around me. I mean, how do you expect me to be that pure? I mean, this is exactly the argument of the Corinthians that Paul had to deal with in 1 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. You don't really expect us to cut ourselves off from idolatry, do you? My neighbor's an idolater. My boss is an idolater. I have family members that are idolaters. And Paul has to deal with that in three chapters to the Corinthians. It's just so easy to go along with the cultural tide. And we've got to be careful that we're not drifting along with it, not looking at a fixed point, but we look at the other people in the rafts all around us, and we're all drifting down the same river. We just are a little bit behind the other ones. No, keep your eyes fixed on the shoreline, not the other people in the floats, you know, the rafts around you. Am I willing to go gladly and quickly where the Lord wants me to go? Or do I dig my heels in and say, "Wait a minute, I have an objection, Lord"? You know, we look at Lot do this and we think, what is wrong with him? Are we quick to do what the Lord wants us to do and see what he wants us to see and take the steps that we need to take in our own lives? And then the last point tonight, I'll just simply say, in regard to what is said in chapter 19, here in verse 16, the Lord being merciful to him. That is, it might have been tempting perhaps for God to say, look, or the angels leading Lot, you want to stay here, stay here. We're trying to save your life. But they didn't. They literally took him and his wife and daughters by the hands and led them out. God was merciful to Lot because there was something, apparently, even though Lot had been affected by all of this, redeeming in him. And I would say that, you know, none of us are going to make it out of Sodom unless the Lord's merciful to us. But we also need to be agreeable to the Lord. We need to follow the Lord's leading. We need to hate what the Lord hates and love what he loves. And when he's warning us to get away from certain things or warning us about a judgment to come, we should flee the other way as quickly as we can and as far as we can. Folks, we don't want to be anywhere near Sodom when it goes up in flames. We don't want to be judged along with the rest of our generation, the rest of our culture. We want to be different and live differently and live by different standards and values than the rest of the world, lest we get caught up and influenced by our culture the way Lot did and the way his daughters did as well. Well, I made it. I didn't even need water. Is there somebody that we can help tonight before we dismiss? We're going to sing a song of encouragement. If you're here tonight and you find that you are in need, that you are in the wilderness, that you've wandered, that you're weak, that you have a need that we can help you with by prayer or by helping you obey the gospel of Jesus Christ and leave the world behind and enter a relationship with him and be cleansed of your sin and have the mercy of God shown to you in all its fullness, as it was shown to Lot. If we can help you, would you come while we stand and sing?